Retired Montana Supreme Court Justice Pat Cotter spoke at a Civics Education Day presented by MSU Wanderlust, the League of Women Voters, and Bozeman Public Library on April 23, 2018. The title of her talk was "The Montana Supreme Court: Structure, Function, and the Law and Principles That Guide the Decision-Making Process."
This is the second of two parts.
True to the outline that we have, I want to talk about what powers the state cannot exercise, why the state can't exercise certain powers, conflicts with federal law, and what happens when there's executive orders and what can happen with those. But before I get there, I want to clear up a couple of things because I had some questions during the break, and I think that there's some additional information I want to give you. Someone asked me, when we talked about the case in which the judge shackled the defendant, and we said that we reversed that decision because of the prejudicial impact of the shackling. What happens after that? Well, it goes back for another trial. And the question was, well, if it goes back for another trial, is the defendant have to have that same judge again? And the answer to that is no. When you get a new trial, there's a statute that allows you to seek to recuse that judge and get a different judge. As a practical matter, a lot of people don't do that, but they do exercise that right if there's a judge that has really, you know, consistently issued rulings that the person doesn't like and wants to see somebody else take a look at it. There was also a question about picking a jury. A couple questions. One was, do we also have six men and women juries in Montana? And the answer to that is yes. People can choose to have a six-man jury. Those are usually in cases in which there's a county court, like a court of limited jurisdiction trial, where it has six cases. But in felony cases, it has to be 12. Okay? But the parties can't agree to have six jurors in some cases. But the question also asked was picking a jury. How can you pick a jury? I mean, what are your rights if you have a person who's sitting on the jury panel or who's going to be interviewed for the jury that comes out with some outrageous remark? What can you do? What happens is that the clerks of court subpoena a certain number of people for each case when they know it's going to trial. You get your jury summons and you better show up, right? You've probably all done that before in one way or the other. And depending if it's a big, complicated case or a controversial case, they'll probably summon up to 150 prospective jurors. If it's a run-of-the-mill case, there might be 30 to 40 prospective jurors. And each party in a case has a right to challenges to jurors. There are two kinds of challenges. One is a challenge for cause, and one is a peremptory challenge. Now, a challenge for cause can be made. For example, I've got the jury. When you're on a jury, when you're summoned for jury duty, you have to answer questionnaires, okay, and return them. Those questionnaires for every potential juror go to the lawyers who are going to be trying the case with that jury group. So the lawyers have already looked at that and said, okay, is there anybody in here I have to weed out? Is Uncle Jim on the jury panel? He's gone. He's not going to serve. Is somebody that is associated, is my employer on the jury panel, or the employer of somebody who's critical in the case? They're gone. If there's a pivotal witness and their spouse or something is on the jury panel, they're gone. Because we want the credibility of the jurors to be judged by people who are not indifferent, but who are neutral as to the witnesses. Sometimes police officers get challenged as a matter of cause in a criminal case because the witnesses who are going to testify are going to be police officers. And a police officer who's a juror is certainly going to give greater credibility to the police officer's testimony than they would give to somebody else's testimony. So you can have unlimited numbers of challenges for cause. But a judge has to rule, yes, this qualifies as a challenge for cause, and I'm going to excuse that juror. Okay? So you get unlimited ones, but the judge rules on them. The other type of challenge is called a peremptory challenge. And generally speaking, each party to a case gets 4 peremptory challenges. A peremptory challenge is a challenge that you can make without giving a reason. You've been watching the faces of the jury when people and lawyers are asking them questions, trying to pick a jury, and you see somebody that you really don't like, that you can tell doesn't like your client, but you know it's not enough to get that person challenged for cause. So you can say, I'm going to exercise a peremptory challenge and excuse juror number 14. Again, though, you get only 4. So you have to start hedging your bets. If you get up to 3 and there's still other people sitting out there and you're thinking, God, who's going to take his place up there on that panel? You know, I could be stuck with someone that's even worse. So there's a lot of judgment calls that go into picking a jury. I'm going to talk briefly about a Batson challenge. I don't know if you've ever heard that expression before. This came up and made federal law, or the United States Supreme Court issued a decision in this case, where, you know, we say we can excuse anybody for a peremptory challenge. People were starting to excuse people of color. The state might excuse people of color when the defendant is a person of color. Now, they only have so many peremptory challenges, so the state might say, well, I'm going to move to excuse this person because they're from the same community, they live in the same neighborhood. They try and come up with reasons to excuse those people for cause. And eventually it came finally to the court's attention that people of color were being taken off juries in cases in which the defendant was a person of color. So in a Batson challenge, and I'm not going to go into too much detail, you have to give a non-discriminatory reason for excusing people of color when the person that is the defendant is the same color. Okay? It's a little more complicated than that, but that's called a Batson challenge. You cannot throw people off a jury panel just because you want an all-white jury to judge a black person, or all-Hispanic jury to judge a white person, something like that. So you do get you get to excuse jurors, and your goal is, of course, the stated goal is to find the best impartial 12 people. In reality, each party wants to get the people that might be most partial to their client, right? And that's what they want on the jury panel. They want somebody who's going to be sympathetic to their situation. So if you've got a case in which somebody is a paraplegic as a result of a car accident, if you're the plaintiff's lawyer, you would like to have somebody whose family member has paraplegia, because they're going to be empathetic. If you're on the other side, you don't want that person on the jury. Okay? So there's a lot of what goes behind the scenes, what goes into selecting a jury. And again, it ends up being who you can get, the best you can do to get certain people on. And still, it's unpredictable. It's not predictable what they're going to do. But certain characteristics of people might suggest to you that he or she's not going to be a good juror for me. Okay. Another question that came up was issues of venue. We have statutes that say when a case is about a contract or a case is about a tort, a civil wrong, the place where the injury occurs, the case has to be tried in that county, for example, and that's an oversimplification. But there are venue statutes that say, you know, like when I sued the person in Hill County, remember I told you about I didn't want to try that to a jury because of the favoritism that it might show to a Hill County person. Someone said, well, why didn't you just move your case? Well, I can't. Because in that case, the defendant resides in Hill County and the accident occurred in Hill County. And those two things go into the legal determination of where the case has to be tried. And the question presented to me was, well, couldn't you get a change of venue because you weren't going to get a fair shot in front of a Haver jury? No. There are ways that you can change venue based upon a prejudicial venue, but the barrier is very high. Otherwise, people would be changing cases all the time to try and find forum shopping is what they call it. You're trying to find some other forum that's better for you. You can get a change of venue only, and I'm oversimplifying, but the most typical request for change of venue that might be entertained by the court is a case in which it is an explosive case in the community and the press has weighed in a lot. The press has disclosed certain things about the defendant that they shouldn't know, that the public shouldn't know, for example. Or the press has published editorials saying, this guy deserves the death penalty. You know, when it's that inflammatory, and you can demonstrate that the members of the community know about this case, they've read the newspaper, they've listened to the radio editorials, then you might be able to convince a judge that the case has to be tried in a different community. But it's hard to do. It's hard to establish. So when you're stuck with going to Haver, and I don't mean to badmouth Haver, really. Haver's a very nice place. But when you're stuck with going to Haver with a Haver community favorite, you know, you just have to do the best you can. And I'm, in my situation, when I said I want to try it before the court, I expected the other side, it was a civil case, to say, I want a jury trial. And if he or she wanted the jury trial, I can't override that. But he agreed to try it to the court, which saved my bacon, I think, in that case, because I had a judge that was just going to decide it on the law and knowing what the law was, whereas otherwise I might have a jury that would be sympathetic to the defendant because she was not a pillar of the community. No offense to her, right? But she was a person well-known in the community. Okay. So, changing horses. We talked a little bit about the Supremacy Clause. We talked about the Supremacy Clause a little bit, and I said that the Constitution and the laws of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby. Okay, that's the Supremacy Clause. It also provides that all members of Congress and state legislatures and all executive and judicial officers shall take an oath to support the Constitution. So, what the Supremacy Clause means, boiled down to its essence, is that if federal law requires a certain thing, if the federal Constitution requires a certain thing, if the federal courts require a certain thing, state courts cannot just ignore it and go their own way. And someone said to me, well, what about Montana's got a right of privacy? Isn't that ignoring the federal Constitution? And the difference is that there is nothing in the federal law or the federal Constitution that says there is no right of privacy. Okay? It's silent. So in that situation, states can give that greater right, the right to a clean and healthful environment, because nothing in the federal Constitution or federal law prohibits it. So that's the difference. And the question was put to me, well, what if the FBI comes in and wants to tape record a conversation? Well, under federal law, they don't need the consent of both people. Okay? So federal law would govern in the federal case. And under the federal law, they might be able to record the conversation and use it against them, but not in state court, not under state law. I know it's a little confusing because sometimes there's an overlap, but that's the way. Is this cutting out?
Yes. Can everyone hear?
Yeah.
No.
Oh,
well.
Covering. I was going to talk about Citizens United in this part of this presentation, but I already did that. So I'm scratching that piece of paper. But another clause of the United States Constitution that comes into play a lot and that can override the right of states to do certain things is the Commerce Clause, okay? Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3 of the Constitution says, Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. Pretty simple. But it has become more and more important as times have changed and people travel more and there's more mobility of citizens in the United States. For example, you cannot have a state law that impedes the flow of goods and services across state lines. Okay? That's the realm of Congress and not the states. What if we had a law in Montana that said you can have only these particular kinds of tires on our highways because we don't want our highways to be trashed by, you know, studs, for example, or different things on tires? That would impede interstate commerce because people cross state lines all the time, and they have to be able to cross state lines without having to change their tires when they do. Another example is particulates in the air. How can you require certain particulates in Montana when the air flows across state lines and another state may not have that same requirement. So in so many instances, in commerce, in all sorts of activities among the citizens of different states, the Commerce Clause is going to preclude a state from enacting legislation that will impede the flow of goods and services across state lines. And you hear the Commerce Clause recited frequently in United States Supreme Court cases as precluding legislation that would impede the flow of goods and services across state lines. So what do we have? We have the Supremacy Clause and we have the Commerce Clause, the two of the big impediments to state regulation. But what do we have in the Constitution as well? We have the 10th Amendment. You've probably heard a lot of people refer to that. The 10th Amendment of the United States Constitution, not Montana now, the United States. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Okay, the 10th Amendment, we call it a residuary clause because it says any power not delegated to the United States, the people get to exercise, the people of the several states. So there's conflicts there. And a lot of people, you've heard in arguments, the states ought to be able to control federal lands, for example, right? We want the federal lands to be the business of the states. We don't want the federal government throwing us off federal lands or anything like that. We want the states to control those pieces of property. Well, it's not that you can't do that, okay? Even though we had the situation with the people in Idaho, Washington?
Oregon,
thank you. I knew it was one of those states up in the corner, where they were occupying federal lands, and they were saying this is the right of the states to do this, and the feds were saying, no, it is not. These are federal lands. But, you know, underlying all of these different things is the question of enforcement. A law can be on the books, but it's a question of whether it's going to be enforced by the sovereign. A classic example, and I'm going to tell this story, I'm kind of out of school on myself, is recreational marijuana. Under the federal law, marijuana is a Schedule I drug, meaning it is one of the most prescribed drugs there is. It's right up there with opiates and different things. It is forbidden. It is a crime to possess and distribute marijuana. Well, states have legalized it, haven't they? And what has happened, the reason I kind of laughed about it is at the time when I was on the court, Montana's United States attorney was my husband.
Right.
So, you know, there would be, yeah, usually that wouldn't be a conflict because they're separate sovereigns, right? And it wasn't a conflict because we never ruled on this particular issue, but the federal government has the right to criminalize and has criminalized marijuana. But what has happened is that some of these states have passed recreational marijuana laws, and under the Obama administration, there was no will to go after people for possession of marijuana. They just, you know, the federal courts, federal prosecutors could have done it because it's a federal law. States can try to disagree with federal law, but if the push comes to shove and the feds decide to enforce that law, then it, under the Supremacy Clause, it governs, okay? When my husband was United States attorney, there were a couple of raids on one day of big marijuana dispensaries where there were weapons and there was marijuana going out the door and being sold across state lines. But there was never any prosecution of people using recreational marijuana. There was not a will to enforce the law. Now, under this administration, there seems to be a greater will to possibly enforce it. So it goes to prove that even given the Supremacy Clause, different administrations are going to act on different laws differently. So what the Obama administration may not have prosecuted doesn't mean that under the Trump administration there cannot be prosecution. Interestingly enough, Chuck Schumer has apparently within the last week indicated he's going to introduce a bill in the Senate to decriminalize marijuana federally.
Yeah.
Now, whether that'll pass or not, I don't know. But if that happens, then there goes the conflict. There's no longer a conflict between state and federal law, and the states are free to do what they've done. But at this point, I think we have up to 10 states who have, to some extent, legalized recreational marijuana. It would be very hard, I think, for the federal government to crack down to the extent of prosecuting people in possession. This is my opinion. This is not law. Don't quote me. But I think it would be very hard for the federal government to try and prosecute the use of marijuana recreationally at this point because they've let it go for so long, right? States would argue. There's a doctrine called laches, and L-A-C-H-E-S. When the government sleeps on its rights and doesn't do anything, and it gets to the point where people are saying, well, obviously the feds aren't going to prohibit this, so we're going to go ahead and go to the effort of passing laws and everything to allow this in our state. The argument would be, you know, you've slept on your rights, government. It's too late to start, unringing that bell in the states. I'm not saying that would be a successful argument, but it would certainly be one I would argue if I was a state that had legalized marijuana on the belief or supposition that it's not going to be attacked by the federal government. Okay? But again, push comes to shove. As long as marijuana is a Schedule I drug, federal law does still reign supreme if it's enforced. Let's go to a question that was, I think, put in the outline, which seems to be topical. Can a court or Congress overturn an executive order? We have a president who has issued many, many executive orders since he took office, and it's not a tool that is used as frequently by other presidents, but it's been used a lot. I think President Trump started day one with one or two or more executive orders, and he's issued a lot of them. Now, the United States Constitution does not explicitly provide for executive orders. But the right to declare executive orders has been implied by certain courts because of the powers of the executive. So we talk about checks and balances. If the President of the United States or the Governor of Montana and the state government and our sovereign issues an executive order, can courts overturn it? Can Congress overturn it? Let's talk about Congress first. Congress could enact legislation that said that provisions of the executive order should not take legal effect. They could pass that law. But what happens? What does the president have? He has the right of veto, doesn't he? And if he vetoes that law, then two-thirds of Congress have to vote to overturn the veto. So for Congress to simply say that executive order is not going to take effect is likely to be unsuccessful. But other things Congress can do, if the president issues an executive order pursuant to existing federal legislation, Congress could amend or repeal that law, which would moot or render ineffective the executive order. Congress can refuse to fund whatever the executive order applies to. If it requires funding, Congress could say, we're not going to fund it. But what frequently happens, and I think is happening these days, is that some of these executive orders are aspirational or kind of vague. You know, they seem to be heralding a change in the law, but there's been no legislation passed. And if an executive order is not capable of being implemented without the legislature implementing it, I think what the legislature and most people would say is just let it be. I mean, just let it ride, because it's not going to be implemented without statutes that would implement the course of conduct that the president wants to forward. Now, the courts is a different story, and we had the courts active with respect to one executive order, and that was the the travel ban involving persons of Muslim descent. The president issued an executive order saying that we're not going to allow certain people to come into the state. And a couple of courts declared that unconstitutional on several grounds. I think equal protection of the laws because it was discriminatory, you know, on several grounds. The president came back and changed the law or changed the executive order. And what he did, essentially, at least in the eyes of some of the courts, is removed the constitutional impediments to the extent that the executive order could go forward. So when we talk about checks and balances, each of the three branches has some sort of check on the other branches. Courts can declare laws unconstitutional if they violate the Constitution. Executives can, or legislatures can come back and remove the constitutional impediment and pass it again. Legislatures, if the president issues an executive order that the courts overturn, the president can change it and remove the constitutional impediment. So the checks and balances are such that there is always, just about always, a way that the other branches of government can get around that, but they have to remove the constitutional impediment before they can overcome that particular order. Let's talk about when a court can invalidate a law passed by the legislature. Okay, and we touched on that briefly when we talked about the Montana Supreme Court throwing out the statute that criminalized same-sex conduct. It doesn't frequently happen that we're asked to overturn a law of the legislature. I could think of two or three other occasions. We had there was a law passed with respect to insurance with respect to state insurance policies, where state employees had the right to add their spouse as an insured on the policy, or they could add their partner, but it was the heterosexual partner that could be added and not a partner of the same gender. And that was challenged on constitutional grounds. And it was fascinating because our court ruled, you know, that's discriminatory. You're discriminating. You're saying that unmarried partners of heterosexual partners are entitled to be on the insurance policy of a state employee, but homosexual unmarried partners are not entitled to be on the policy. There's no difference in the type of health care that's going to be involved. The state can't provide a compelling state interest. Remember, we talked about that burden. The state has no compelling interest in saying, we'll insure your unmarried partner if she's a different sex than you are, sir, but we will not insure your unmarried partner with whom you've made a commitment. This is before marriage, the whole marriage thing came out. And the court said that was unconstitutional. It was fascinating because the state then was thinking about taking that appeal up to the United States Supreme Court. And again, this is before the Obergefell case, which was the Supreme Court case on same-sex marriage. But a funny thing happened. The insurance company said, you know, there's no reason why we shouldn't allow these partners to be covered. And so they agreed, and the law was changed, and they went ahead and extended coverage. So sometimes things work that way. Sometimes decisions of the courts really do make a change without there being bitter litigation to the very end. And that was one of those situations. That case was decided 4-3. Three members of the court said, you can make that distinction, and four members of the court said it's an unconstitutional discrimination to make that distinction if you cannot establish a compelling interest to do so.
Do you remember what year that was?
It was between 2001 and 2004. Snet, the party's name, I can't remember, I believe I remember this. The plaintiff's name was Snetsinger. Snetsinger.
But the insurance companies could probably read the writing on the wall.
Well, yeah, and it turned out to be the right decision, I thought. I was one of the four.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of the complaints about things like this, it comes down to, is it the business of the government to make policy? Yes, it is the business of the government to make policy. But, for example, in the case involving the same-sex partners, the government argued, it's our business to enforce public morals. And that was thin ice, because public morals is a subjective position to take. Does the natural law or the say that it's publicly moral to have a partner of a different gender and publicly immoral to have a partner of the same gender. Is that the state? Is that the business the state should be in? And, you know, 20 years ago, it was definitely the business the state was in. But things have changed a lot. Now that Obergefell is the Supreme Court case that decided that the states and the federal government had no compelling interest in precluding people from marrying if they're the same gender. The California first brought that case up, and the state really tried to justify its law to say, wait a minute. You know, this is always, marriage has always been between a man and a woman. So there is therefore no reason to change it. And that it's not the business of the state to authorize relationships that had not been historically authorized under the law. Something just dawned on me about that. What was it? Oh, I know what it was. Okay, let's talk about this question. I'm going to change horses again. I talked briefly about the initiative that was passed by the voters, Marcy's Law. Okay? This was a victims' rights bill. And what happened is they circulated petitions among voters in all the different districts, and they got the requisite 10% from each district who supported a victims' rights law. And they got enough signatures to get it on the ballot. And the ballot was printed, and Marcy's Law was on the ballot, and the voters passed it. But it was, again, a constitutional amendment that altered and changed a lot of different provisions of the law of the Constitution, or that affected a lot of different provisions of the Constitution. The people that opposed Marcy's Law were law enforcement, for the most part, and communities, because Marcy's Law would have required an expenditure of significant money to bring in people who would set up clinics for persons that were victims of a crime, that would require enforcement of certain laws that convictions are for victims of a crime, mostly because the rights of victims have been protected in the past. It's not like they didn't have any rights. But one of the things this law did, for example, was say that victims of crimes who would, you know, are usually the witness for the prosecution, don't have to answer questions by the other side. They don't have to answer interrogatories or go through discovery. They don't have to give information. That they are insulated from a lot of what we routinely expect of witnesses in crimes. That's only a small portion of it. But what the question about Marcy's Law went to the Supreme Court, and again, the court threw it out because it amended too many parts of the Constitution. And this raises this question. Wait a minute. People have the right of initiative. They have a right to propose this. The majority of the people in this state wanted Marcy's Law to be the law. Why isn't the court required to do the will of the people? Is that the obligation of a court? And the answer to that is no. It is the obligation of legislators to listen to their constituents. Some of them don't. But it is the obligation of legislators to do the will of the people when they work in the legislature. It is the executive listens to the will of the people, is not going to act against it. But judges are not tasked with doing the will of the majority. And I think it was de Tocqueville who said, we are a nation of laws, not of men, and talked about protection from the tyranny of the majority. If the majority says that only white people should be able to do such and such a thing and other people cannot, the majority may agree with that, but is it the business of the courts to say, okay, that's what you want, we'll uphold that? We are required to recognize the constitutional rights of all of our citizens. We are required to make sure that there's equal protection of the laws for every person, regardless of their skin color, their religion. We can make some distinctions with respect to age until they turn 21, but for the most part, we are obligated to recognize the rights of all persons on an equal level. And there was a famous case in which this came up, and that was in Skokie, Illinois. Skokie is a community near Chicago that right after, in the 50s and 60s, was populated mostly by Holocaust survivors. And the Nazi Party got a parade permit to march through Skokie. And the ACLU fought for their right to do that. We find their message deplorable, but if they fill out the application for the permit just like anybody else, we're not going to distinguish based upon their viewpoint. The government cannot engage in viewpoint discrimination that says you can have the right of free speech as long as we agree with your viewpoint. So that's been a big topic over the years. But what I wanted to read to you, if I can find it, is what was said in the Obergefell case. Justice Kennedy is an interesting figure on the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't know if all of you know that, but he is a swing vote. If you talk about four justices who are considered liberal, four are considered conservative, he's considered a swing vote. He wrote Citizens United, okay, and got the 5-4. And yet, this is what he said. In he also wrote Obergefell, the case that said that same-sex marriage would be legalized in this country. And I love this. He said, individuals need not await legislative action before asserting a fundamental right. An individual can invoke a right to constitutional protection when he or she is harmed, even if the broader public disagrees and even if the legislature refuses to act. The idea of the Constitution was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, and to establish them as legal principles to be applied by the courts. I think that's a beautiful statement. It's our obligation when constitutional rights are at issue to make sure that everyone is entitled to the same protection for their constitutional rights. So he's an enigma, you know, but I really thought that was a great statement. Another case that I found interesting, and this is a case that we actually, the court goes on the road several times a year. We were here in Bozeman, we go to Missoula, and one time we went up to Glasgow, and we try to select a case for oral argument that the people in the audience will understand, you know, that's not too technically complicated, that people don't just sit there and sleep through it, you know, and there are a lot of those. So this was a case, and it involved the right of privacy. And remember I said that if a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy that the public is willing to acknowledge as significant, it goes a long way in establishing that the right of privacy should apply. This is a case in which the police in Glasgow suspected that someone was operating a meth lab in his home. But they didn't have enough to take to a judge to get a warrant. Remember I talked about how there has to be a sworn affidavit to go to the judge. They wanted to search the house or find out if he was operating a meth lab, but they didn't have enough probable cause to get a warrant. Well, they can't just go into the house without a warrant or without the consent of the people that live in the house. The only only exception is exigency. If you're chasing somebody down the street and he runs into a house with a gun, you can follow him into the house. You don't have to stop and go get a warrant because there's an exigent, immediate circumstance. But for the most part, you need consent or a warrant to get into somebody's house. Well, they didn't have the warrant. They didn't have enough evidence to get it. So what they decided to do, the police, is they waited until he put his garbage on the curb, and they went and grabbed it. Okay? They took it down to the police station, and they went through it, and there were, you know, what's the kind of medication that you have to now buy behind the counter? What is it? Sudafed. There were Sudafed wrappers. There were all sorts of things that indicated that there was a meth lab being operated in that house. So they filled out an application for a search warrant based on what they found in the garbage. And they took it to a judge, and the judge said there's enough evidence here to establish reasonable cause to believe the crime has been committed. They got their search warrant. They went into the house, and sure enough, there's the meth lab. So the defendant is charged with felony intent to distribute methamphetamine and operation of a meth lab. Well, he files a motion to have all of that evidence excluded that was obtained by virtue of the search warrant on the basis that his right of privacy was violated when the police took the garbage from his curb. And is there a privacy interest in your garbage? Oh, boy. I mean, think about what people can learn about you through your garbage. You know, how much you drink, what taxes you owe, if you smoke. I mean, you know, personal hygiene, everything. There's so many things that someone can learn from your garbage. And if the right of privacy means anything, you certainly don't want all of that stuff paraded into a court of law. So he said you have to suppress all of the evidence obtained as a result of the search warrant because my right of privacy was violated. So the state responded, because the state wants to prosecute this case, they want a conviction. The state responded, well, he gave up his right to privacy when he posted his garbage at the curb. Okay? It was, first of all, was it a clear plastic bag? No. That would indicate he didn't care what people saw. It was a black plastic bag. So the defendant is like, look, I put black plastic around this stuff because I had an expectation of privacy that no one would look into my garbage. But the state also argued that when you place your garbage for collection, you abandon your expectation of privacy. Okay? And what happens if you place your garbage at the curb? Number one, somebody could come along and grab it or tear into it. Animals could tear into it and strew it all over the place. And so we were faced with the question, and this was fascinating because we had a bunch of high school students, and they're all like, oh, boy, yeah. You know, they're thinking what's been in their garbage, and they're all over this one. They're like, yeah, that defendant has that right of privacy. But we ruled 5-2. There were two dissenters. That when he posted his garbage for collection, he gave up any reasonable expectation of privacy in the contents of that bag. And that, therefore, the police could collect it and take it away because it was posted for collection. Now, if the garbage bag, this is what makes these cases fascinating. If the garbage bag had been on the front lawn, they couldn't have taken it. Because there had been no intent to abandon it yet. It was still on private property. They couldn't have taken it without a warrant. But once it was posted for collection, any expectation of privacy that these people had was compromised or was lessened, and therefore it would not be, the evidence that was seized would not be suppressed on the basis of right to privacy. So it illustrates how in these cases, one difference in fact, one change in fact, is going to have a difference in terms of how it's analyzed. And that's what I mean about how you can't accuse courts of legislating from the bench when every case they're presented virtually has a different twist of fact, has a different twist of whether a particular law is going to apply or not. Sometimes facts are identical from case to case, but not very often. Not very often. So an inventive state in this case came up with the abandonment argument, which I found persuasive, but two of the court members said, no, you have an expectation of privacy in your garbage unless and until you throw it into the truck. There's another case. But another case that I think you would find interesting is a case involving the right of free speech. Now, I told our reporter here that there was a free speech case that I wasn't going to mention because I'm being recorded. Because it had to do with some vulgarities that were uttered to a public employee and whether that justified his being prosecuted for violation of the law when he called a woman the worst possible thing you can imagine because she wouldn't help him over the telephone. That was a free speech case. And in that case, we said that he could not be prosecuted under a particular statute because even though what he said to her, and it was an adjective and a noun, and you can imagine what it was, even what he said to her was horrible. It was just horrible. There is the right of free speech is so protected that you're not going to be prosecuted for saying something like that to somebody. Only under very narrow grounds are you going to be prosecuted for saying something out loud to somebody else. Okay? One of them is the old classic fire in the theater. If you create public harm or a threat to public harm by your speech, if you threaten somebody with bodily injury, your right to free speech can be curtailed. if your speech is going to incite violence. For example, okay, we had another case, free speech issue. Somebody walking down the street in Missoula, you know how those Missoula people are. Walking down the street in Missoula, and he sees a police officer. It's 2 a.m, and he's drunk. And the police officer passes him in the crosswalk, and this guy calls him an adjective pig to his face. Okay? And the police officer says, "What did you say?" Well, he was kind enough to repeat it very loudly, right in his face. And he was charged with disturbing the peace and with a criminal violation for provoking this case. And he argued he had a right to free speech. We said that when you confront somebody in their face and say something that is likely to provoke a violent reaction, which this would, then it's not protected. But in the case of the man on the phone, it wasn't face-to-face. So that was the distinction there. It was a horrible thing, but if we're going to restrict speech, we can't start restricting speech over the phone. Say, for example, you're on the phone with a state employee and you stub your toe while you're walking around and you utter an expletive. Is that subject to prosecution? It's a slippery slope with these laws as to what exposes you to prosecution and what does not. So let's move to another free speech case, and this one arose in Butte. In this case, a young woman in the public high school in Butte was a valedictorian, and she was going to give her remarks at graduation. And in her remarks, which had to be pre-approved by the school, she wanted to give credit to her Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, for the guidance that he had given her and the protections he had given her throughout her high school career. So her proposed speech was reviewed by the people in the school district. They said, "We're not going to let you say that, because it's proselytizing. You're out there trying to convince people to convert to your faith, and we don't do that in a public school setting." They said, "You can take out the references to our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and we'll let you speak. But as long as it remains in there, you're not going to speak." Well, she didn't speak, and she went to court to vindicate her right of... Now, she argued it on freedom of religion and freedom of speech grounds. We didn't go to the freedom of religion grounds because we resolved it on freedom of speech grounds. We ruled that the school violated her right to free speech, and we rejected the argument. I've got to read this because it's got some technicalities in it. We rejected the argument that her speech would appear to constitute a religious endorsement by the public school. Okay? Only if speech will materially disrupt the work and discipline of the school, if it can be seen as promoting illegal drug use, which didn't apply, or is perceived to bear the imprimatur of the school, may it be limited. And we said, if she's up there saying, you all come to me, and we are going to go to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, it would be seen as something that bore the imprimatur of the school, because it's encompassing, that we're all doing this together. But because she wanted to talk about her personal life and what the Lord meant to her, the school had no right to curtail her freedom of speech. So what happened in that case? Well, it went back to the... Of course, what happens in some of these cases is by the time it's decided by the court, it's moot. I mean, they're not going to hold graduation ceremonies again so she can come back and read them. But what the law does provide in instances such as this, where constitutional rights are vindicated, is the person can go back and ask for attorney fees to be awarded against the school district for her, because she had to expend money to hire a lawyer to vindicate her constitutional right to her freedom of speech. So we sent it back to the district court for determination of fees. So again, it's gradations of fact. One type of presentation would have been, the limitation on it would have been upheld, and another type of presentation, the limitation would not be upheld. All right, last case I want to talk about, and this one was very, very controversial, and it really reflects on how the courts and the legislatures act or interact or fail to do that. This is the case of Baxter versus State of Montana. This case was under the right of dignity. Let's go back to that. Article 2, Section 4, individual dignity. The dignity of the human being is inviolable. No person shall be denied the equal protection of the laws, nor shall the state or any person, firm, or corporation discriminate against any person. Anyway, on and on. But it talks about the right of individual dignity as a fundamental right. Mr. Baxter was terminally ill, and he wanted medication to be prescribed that he could take when he was ready to end his life. And he said that he had a right to die with dignity, so he had a constitutional right to do this. The state took the position that if a physician prescribes this medication that ends someone's life, he or she could be tried for murder. Okay? So the district court listened to the case and reviewed it and said, we're going to side with Mr. Baxter here. Unfortunately, by the time the district court got to it, Mr. Baxter had already died. Okay? So the case was there on the right to individual dignity, and the state appealed the case to us and said there should not be declared a constitutional right to die with medication that's determined to end your life. We had, have you ever heard of amicus curiae or friend of the court briefs? We probably had 40 from as far away as Iceland or Finland or one of those cold countries. But we had friend of the court briefs on both sides. It was interesting who took what position. Disability rights people took a position that that should not be permitted. And why do you think that is? Because they didn't want somebody who had the authority to make decisions for a disabled person making a decision that he or she should have their life ended. Okay? Makes sense. They're very, very distrustful of that. Right to die people said you should have a constitutional right to die with dignity. So we had churches weighing in that said you should not okay this. That's murder. And we had so many people that we couldn't use our regular Supreme Court chambers. We used the old Supreme Court chambers in the courthouse because there were hundreds of people that attended this argument. The general rule is for courts, and it's not written down, but all the courts that have been in the business do this. We do not resolve a case on constitutional grounds if we can do it on statutory grounds. We don't want to issue expansive decisions under the Constitution if we can resolve a case on a statutory ground, within the law that has been passed by the legislature. Well, we decided not to resort to the constitutional analysis because we could resolve this case under state law. There is a law in Montana that says that consent to the commission of a crime is a full defense. Think about it. If the doctor gave the medication to this person and he took the medication and died, who would be prosecuted? Not the dead man. It would be the doctor, wouldn't it? And what we said was that the consent statute could be relied upon by a physician. The consent statute says that if a person, if the victim of a crime, in this case it would be the ill person, is competent to make decisions about his own situation, is not under duress or undue influence by anybody else, and understands the nature of his action, that person can consent to a crime, and the person who committed the crime cannot be charged. Let's take a simple example. Two people, one guy really wants to get into the law enforcement academy. He wants to show how tough he is, so he tells his friend, I want you to tase me. Okay? I want to see if I can withstand it. And he's competent. He consents to the crime. He is not under anybody else's duress or influence. He makes a decision that he wants to be tased. Well, the taser comes out, and boy, he's sorry. And he gets hurt. And this actually happened. And they filed suit against the other person for assault. How's that for gratitude, right? And the consent of that person was considered a defense to the crime. So we said, if doctors prescribe this medication and a person takes it and dies, and that person was competent and not under undue influence and was aware of what his action was, the doctor could interpose consent as a defense to the prosecution. So we said, because that opportunity existed, we are not going to go to the constitutional level. We are going to say that under statutory law, there is a defense for the doctor to interpose if he or she's prosecuted. Now, what happened after that is what's interesting. This was probably 10 years ago. People on both sides of the issue went to the legislature. Okay? Well, the court's not going to do anything, so we advocates for the right to life, we want the legislature to pass a law that says that physician-assisted suicide is a crime. And then the other side came in and says, no, we want you to pass a law that says physician-assisted suicide is not a crime, so that there's no dispute about it, no question. And both bills from both sides were considered in several legislatures, and neither one ever got enough of a majority to become law, because there's so much of a division of opinion on whether or not that should be the law or whether or not the legislature should act in that regard. I have no question, excuse me, that someone's going to try it again, because an issue about which a lot of people are passionate, for understandable reasons. I mean, it's a significant decision and issue to take your own life. Some states permit doctors to do this under state law. Oregon is one of them. Other states criminalize it, but we haven't done either one in this state because the legislators cannot gin up. No, they cannot gin up enough. No, the law was, the law in Montana was that murder, the general feeling was, and I think it happened one time, if a physician prescribes that medication, we'll charge him with murder. Was he prosecuted? Was he convicted? Yeah. It never came to our court, but see, that she just said that one doctor in Addis was prosecuted for giving life-ending medication to a patient. And it's because the populace is so split on that issue that we can't get laws passed saying one or the other on that issue. I want to make a quick pitch for something that's very important to me before we open it up to questions, and that is the right of people of limited means to an attorney. We all know that defendants in criminal cases, as I mentioned, have a right to an attorney. If you're threatening to take away their liberty and put them in prison, they have a right to counsel if they can't afford an attorney. But people of limited or moderate means who can't afford an attorney for cases like divorce, child custody, landlord-tenant when they're being evicted from their properties, they have no right to an attorney under Montana law because it would be far too expensive to give. We don't have the money to do what we're trying to do now, much less give every person of moderate or limited means the right to an attorney in civil cases. There are a lot of different groups that are banding together to volunteer to give people the right or help as attorneys. Attorneys are coming forward and acting pro se for people, meaning they're not charging a fee to help people get through and navigate the process. And it's important not only for the individual dignity of people who all they want is not to be evicted or all they want is to protect their children, get a protective order, get a divorce, things like that, but they don't have a lawyer. They have the same right as anyone else to due process of the law. And so we're really working around the state, and the Supreme Court's been involved in this effort, to get more people the type of assistance that they need to get their rights protected as civil litigants who can't afford an attorney. I am a retired person, and I can't give advice. So I didn't advise any of you people here, just so y'all know. I can't give advice because I'm not a member of the bar anymore, full member of the bar, but I am an emeritus member of the bar, which means I can volunteer for legal services to the poor, which I do. But libraries are now being approached about putting in forms and things, even in public libraries that people can have access to try and help them navigate the civil justice system. Without an attorney because they can't afford one. And there are two reasons it's important: the dignity of the people who deserve to have the same protection of the laws as others, but also the court system is being inundated with pro se litigants. people who say, I'm coming to court, I don't have a lawyer, but ready or not, here I come. And they come into a court, they want a divorce, they haven't filled out any forms, they don't know what their law is, and the judge has to slow down the process in order to explain the law to them, help them get their forms filled out. Some judges will do it, others say, I don't have time. I can't give you legal advice, I've got to decide a whole bunch of cases. So these pro se cases are taking an inordinate amount of time in district courts and in the Supreme Court. We have probably one in every seven cases is filed by a person who doesn't have a lawyer. And their appeal doesn't meet the requirements of the rules, doesn't spell out what relief they want. Rules that we impose upon people with lawyers, are we supposed to say people without lawyers get a better deal? It's hard to say. You can't really, you have to treat everybody the same. So if one set of rules applies to one group, it should apply to everybody. So that's the difficulty that the civil justice system faces in this state. So if you hear about movements afoot to get more help, maybe an AmeriCorps volunteer in your libraries to help people navigate the civil justice system, please support it because it's important. So, okay, questions. This man has had his hand up for a while out back here in the corner. Way back there. Sorry. Thanks. Yes.
Just recently, John Paul Stevens spoke about repealing the Second Amendment.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm just curious how would it keep either federal or state constitutions from becoming anachronisms? Because I think that there's a method to repeal it as a component of the Constitution. But it's highly...
It's difficult. You need three-fifths. Yeah.
That it's unlikely ever.
Ever.
And so therefore, we're working with it, you know, old documents that, not so much in Montana's case, but in certainly the federal Constitution, that there are anachronisms.
Yep.
They were protecting rights that weren't designed to do the protection that...
Well, and the interesting thing about the Second Amendment in the federal Constitution is...
I really want to ask more generally, because... That is, you know, like, what can citizens do to change? I mean, I think that the first thing has to happen is to change the burdensome requirement for changing an amendment. That, I don't know how to do that.
It's not, I don't think you would be able to do that.
Yeah, right.
So then are we stuck?
Well, you know, I hate to say this, but yes, in a sense. The Second Amendment... in the federal Constitution is very, very hard to understand. It's very poorly written. And for 100 and almost 200 years, yes, it was interpreted as applying only to the rights of militia to bear arms.
Right.
The irony is that in the late 60s, when police were carrying weapons and there was a lot of unrest, the Black Panthers started carrying rifles on the street. So Sacramento, where they were having problems, passed a law that says that individuals didn't have the right to carry guns on public streets. Up until that point, the NRA had simply been a group that helped train kids how to handle weapons safely. And they underwent a big philosophical change and said, wait a minute, Black Panthers have a point. You know, under the Second Amendment, people do have the right to bear arms outside of the militia. So it was an unusual kind of alignment of interests that led the court to change the way it interpreted the Second Amendment. Because up until the 70s, the court did not interpret the Second Amendment to give the right to bear arms to individuals. Now, in Montana, I don't know, I'm going to read you the Second Amendment on the federal Constitution because I find it so bad. It's one sentence. A well-regulated militia, comma, being necessary to the security of a free state, comma, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Does that what does that refer to? The right of the people to bear arms or the right of the militia to use arms? And that's why it took a couple of hundred years before the U.S. Supreme Court changed the interpretation of the Second Amendment. If you have a Montana case involving the right to bear arms, it's pretty clear. The right of any person to keep or bear arms in defense of his own home, person, and property, or in the aid of civil power when thereto legally summoned, shall not be called in question. Okay? So there's a right to bear arms here. But your point, I think, is it's I can say this out loud, I think. The originalists on the United States Supreme Court want the Constitution to be interpreted as intended by the drafters. Certainly the drafters did not contemplate AR-15s. So if it seems to me that originalists want to keep things the way they were intended to be 200 years ago, then we ought to have a right to bear muskets or small weapons, but certainly not this kind of a weapon. And I think there's a lot of, like you say, a lot of interest in trying to change that dynamic, but to pass an amendment to the United States Constitution takes 3/5 of the states. And that under the will of the people in this country now, I think even more so than it was 20 or 30 years ago, I don't see that that's going to happen. So unless the legislature is willing to pass limitations on what type of weapons can be carried and then is able to successfully defend that against challenges in this United States Supreme Court, I think it's a tough uphill climb.
So, like, just to change it to a majority instead of 3/5, is that that's also
3/5 would have to vote to change it to a majority, and yeah, and the lobby that is trying to do that is obviously going to have an interest in a certain law being changed. So, do you think 3/5 of the states are going to agree to change it to a majority? It's terribly hard to amend, and it ought to be hard to amend in a constitution, but I understand what you're saying. I think it's a real tough hill to climb. Yeah.
I have a question about putting your garbage out on the curb. Do you give up the rights to your garbage? Can anybody come around and go through your garbage once you put it out to the curb?
Oh, sure.
Can only the police do it?
No, I mean we put some constraints on police when we said that they could grab it. We didn't say they had to have probable cause to grab it because that's the warrant requirement, but we said a particularized suspicion would be enough, that they can't just come and grab it because they think it would be fun to just rummage through it for the hell of it. They can't do that. They have to reach at least a particular level of suspicion to grab it. But you think about it. If you put your garbage out, I mean, anybody can and probably does come along and pick it up.
Legally, anybody can walk.
It's on the. What do you call that? The public right of way. It's not sitting on your lawn. It's on the public right of way where you post your garbage, and so your protection or expectation of privacy changes depending on where it's sitting.
But it's in the tote that you pay for.
Yeah. All those arguments were made. Trust me. Yes, you in the back.
Marcy's Law, where does that stand right now?
It's gone.
So is there active actions underway to do sections of it?
There could be. And if they did move to amend different sections separately, you know, when a constitutional initiative goes on the ballot, there's an obligation under the statutes that say there has to be an explanation of X number of words of what this means and what portions of the Constitution it changes. Well, the explanation in this one didn't explain the different portions of the Constitution that would be amended with the passage. If they came back and moved serially to amend different portions, it would withstand that criticism. Yeah.
Justice Cotter, I just wanted to give a small point of correction. We do have a self-help law center. My name is Pam Poon. I'm an attorney here.
Yeah.
I was a founding member of our local Gallatin Legal Assistance Clinic, which provides free legal services to family law clients who are of low income.
Thank you for saying that, Pam.
But I think there's also the amazing free self-help law centers that we have on at Law Justice Center, where people can go and get those forms. And there's a wonderful person on the Montana Supreme Court staff who has helped develop pro bono services for Montana.
She really has, and I know who you mean. And we do use AmeriCorps volunteers, too,
yes,
to help people, help explain brief forms. But thank you for pointing that out. There's just a lot of, one of the other things that there's a movement afoot is to allow lawyers to give advice over the phone, mm-hmm, So a lawyer, if I'm volunteering from Helena, I can help a person in Glasgow. One of the things we haven't gotten to yet is uniformity of forms throughout the state, which I really wish we would get to, because then I'm on the phone and I can say I'm looking at the same form that Glasgow courts would use, and that's our next big push. But yes, thank you, Pam, for that clarification. Yeah.
Would you talk about citizens' initiatives, and particularly the bathroom citizens'
There is a citizens. Is that it? Yeah, that's coming up for a vote, isn't it?
They're collecting signatures.
And I think you had talked to me earlier and said, when does a court intervene in those? Okay? Because the citizens' initiative is reviewed by people to make sure that it's not a violation of the Constitution. Sometimes that doesn't always work. But it goes on the ballot and it gets voted on. Now, there is a statutory right to challenge an initiative before it gets voted on. But it has to, the courts have historically been reluctant to intervene prematurely. And the argument of the people that say don't intervene unless it passes is, we don't have to pass on the constitutionality of it if it doesn't pass the voters. So we exercise our obligation to use some restraint, and we sit back and say we're not going to rule on the legality of it pre-vote. We've done it before. We have ruled on things before it went to a vote of the people. When they tried to change the Constitution to make members, people who were running for the Montana Supreme Court, run from districts rather than run statewide. And it was an attempt to kind of gerrymander the way the court would be. And we did rule on that ahead of time. Even though we were challenged, they said, you can't rule on this. It's your self-interest, you know. But for the most part, we use the restraint to say we're not going to rule on it because it could be moot if the public doesn't pass it. But if the public passes it, then a challenge can be made to it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's probably a silly question, but so if the case for marijuana, if it becomes legalized, thinking about overcrowded prisons, would people that went to jail over that still have to serve their sentences?
It would be, and that's an interesting question. Yes, they would.
Okay.
The laws are, when they're enacted, are almost always prospective only in nature. There are some exceptions to that. A law can be retroactive under certain circumstances, but for the general rule is laws are prospective. So if there's a change in the law after somebody's been convicted under what was a valid law at the time, their prison sentence is not going to be commuted. The case we had before us here in Bozeman was an ex post facto challenge. You cannot pass a law that criminalizes behavior that has already been committed and say, guess what? You couldn't be prosecuted before, but now you can. And this was a case in which, I can't remember which a man, somebody was exonerated based on DNA from a rape of a child. And they had DNA, but they had never had it identified. Okay, they had DNA from her underwear. And in 2004, this rape occurred in 1988.
Yeah.
In 2014, a man committed a crime, and they had since that time started DNA base. They took his DNA. They ran it against unsolved crimes and found his DNA on her underwear. So the state has attempted to prosecute him. But there is an absolute decision from the U.S. Supreme Court that if the statute of limitations on a particular crime has run, and in this one, the statute of limitations kept getting longer and longer, but the legislature amended the statute of limitations while the existing statute of limitations was still in place to extend it. But with this man, the last possibility of him having been prosecuted was in 2007. And so to prosecute him where the statute of limitations had run and there was no basis for the legislature to try and change the statute of limitations to reach back and grab him, you can't do it. At least that's what the law is. Now, the Supreme Court hasn't decided the case, but the argument was pretty strong, regardless of how heinous this crime was, that, you know, there's a pretty strong chance he will not be prosecuted because it's an ex post facto law that looks back to allow him to be criminally charged with something he could not be charged with under other circumstances. Yeah.
On the right to die case, physicians insisted, you were saying it was kind of judicial restraint by avoiding going to the dignity issue, right to die, and the constitutionality by saying, well, the case could be decided under state law.
Right.
How did that play out among the justices? Meaning there was some, you know, the issues that you were sort of not taking into account, you know, in terms of, my understanding is today, doctors are not assisting people with medical issues to die because they're afraid of being, you know, charged with murder until there's a clear interpretation that says the state will not prosecute them.
And that could,
was avoided, I think.
That could be, although I think there are also many, many doctors who, let's face it, who help their clients pass on when they're at a particular point and it's not prosecuted. But I think there are doctors. And I'm not talking about giving them medication to take home and take and commit suicide. But we all know doctors act in a, they withdraw support, they withdraw food, they do things that hasten the death of someone. I mean, that's part of their you know, their care of their patients. You know, when that patient is not going to be ever survive or revive, and doctors sometimes make decisions to, well, with the consent of the family and the person's unconscious and has a living will, we're going to withdraw life support. So doctors do that frequently, but this is a situation where it's medication. So I don't know what doctors are doing in response to that. And we, the, you know, that's the whole old argument that legislators pass the law, the Supreme Court has no business declaring what the law should be. And we generally are reluctant to take a situation and declare something to be the law when there's no statutory authority for it. So, which isn't a good answer, but it's the best one I've got. Yeah.
Indian or tribal courts, do they come under Montana? No. Do they have to embrace the Montana?
Well, I shouldn't say that. It's way more complicated than I'm trying to make it. I mean, it's way more complicated than I can say. The tribal courts have jurisdiction over persons within the boundaries of the reservation to the extent that they are tribal members. There's the Violence Against Women Act, which was passed by the federal government during the Obama administration, allows some tribal courts to also take action to prosecute non-Indian persons who assault women on the reservation. There's a blend in there, and I am not a tribal law expert, and you really literally need to be one to answer some of these questions. But they have the right to make their own laws. They have the right to have their own judicial system.
Yeah. I'm curious on that brief case with the young woman that was a valedictorian. Was there any thought or conversation of church and state, the public school?
Well, yeah, that was the whole point, because the public school felt that allowing her to do this would appear to give the imprimatur of the public school to her faith beliefs, and that was the whole basis for the state to, or for the school to say, we're not going to let you say that. And so we said, because she had the right to tell what was important to her and express her own beliefs and not make it a proselytizing, preaching thing, that her right to free speech survived that kind of challenge. Yeah. Yeah.
Another state versus federal rights, and the subject we haven't talked about is the immigration and executive orders for the federal government and sanctuary cities and laws within the states. How much rights do the states have at this point to?
That remains to be seen, because federal law, I mean, immigration is a federal issue. Federal law governs immigration. And so the states that are saying, you know, the sanctuary cities are being threatened with a withdrawal of funding that they would otherwise get from the federal government for certain programs if they don't go along with allowing seizure of people. I don't know how that's going to come out. I just don't know. Did you have a thought on it? It does.
There was just a decision Chicago's attempt to identify itself and maintain its sanctity as a sanctuary city, and the court decided in favor of the city.
Was it a state court or a federal court?
That's my question, Jean.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, if
just within the last couple of days.
Okay, okay. If it's a state court decision, there'll be a supremacy clause argument on that. If it's a federal court decision, and you know they can, it will go through the federal courts and possibly to the Supreme Court on whether. And you know, it depends upon the activity. I mean, some of these states are saying, you know, we're a sanctuary city. We're not going to, allow you to come into our jails and. You know, if somebody's in prison for a misdemeanor or something, and go check his documents or his papers and yank him out of there, which has been happening in different places, we're going to work to protect them. And I'd be interested to know if that was a federal or a state court.
Well, my inkling is to say, yes, it was a federal court, because other federal courts were federal Trump's executive.
Federal court? Thanks.
Have been overturned, you know, by a federal court. My next question, with respect to the same-sex couples insurance coverage case, what was the basis for dissenting opinions?
You know, I'm trying to think. I think that the dissenting opinions felt, or the dissenters felt, that there was a compelling state interest that would allow the state to say, we regulate insurance and we're not going to increase our insurance pool beyond what has typically been our insurance pool. And what the reason that came up is because their insurance plan said, if you have a same-sex partner that's living with you, then you can put that person, same-sex heterosexual partner, you can put that person on your policy. And it didn't say, no, say, I'm sorry, I'm tiring a little bit. The insurance law said that if you had what amounted to a common law marriage, you were living with a person, a person of the opposite sex in a committed relationship, you could have that person insured under your policy. And so someone tried to get insurance for their same-sex partner, committed partner, and the insurance company said, no, you can't, and under our provisions of the law, you cannot add your partner to the case.
Because the language wasn't sufficiently.
It was specific, and it said a heterosexual unmarried partner. Yeah. Yes.
You said the language just escaped me. The clean air and water language that's in our Constitution, and you responded earlier to the question that it hadn't really risen to the top yet. Do you see a case coming up that it really could be pushed?
And I shouldn't say it hasn't risen to the top. It has been interposed, but.
Risen to the top in terms of actually enacting.
Oh, no. There are no laws that will implement regulations guaranteeing us a clean and healthful environment. There are laws, certainly, that require certain actions to be taken before a mine can be opened, before a mine can be changed, and there are, you know, intermittent administrative levels that things have to go through in order to get particular changes to mining done, or, you know, getting leach ponds away, or, you know, doing all the different things that can be done to clean up the environment. But they're not.
Do you see anything that could actually rise to?
No, and one of the reasons is that there's strong lobbies against that kind of thing from all sorts of different industries. But the notion of a clean and healthful environment, I mean, death and life are pretty clear cut. Clean and healthful environment, I think some people will say, is pretty subjective. It's in the, and so for the legislature to pass a law that says your right to clean and healthful environment means this, there aren't a majority of people who are going to agree the extent to which that right is extended. It's still in the Constitution.
It's nice language, but it's
and it's an argument that a lot of people use, and I'm not saying it's never been relied upon, but it's difficult to decide a case solely on the basis of the clean and healthful environment guarantee.
But if we were Flint, Michigan, that could be
used. I would think that could be used as punishment.
Well, I'm just saying.
No, absolutely. Well, that's exactly the, yeah, yeah.
Is there something?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I think we're done.